You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, I'll be joined by Daniela Peled and Shashank Joshi to look at the day's big stories, including Israel's continuing onslaught against Gaza and international reaction to it, and the ongoing attempts to figure out precisely who might have been responsible for shooting down the Malaysia Airlines jet over Ukraine last week, as the Netherlands holds a national day of mourning as the first bodies come home. We'll hear from the theatre critic Matt Wolfe about the latest openings in London and pay our tribute to the inimitable Elaine Stritch.
I don't know what to say about humour, except thank God for it. I can change the subject of my life with humour when it's down. I can change it like that.
Plus, we'll check in with our correspondent in Bamako and meet the athlete, coach, playwright and author Tom McNabb, whose classic novel Flanagan's Run is being reissued to coincide with Glasgow's Commonwealth Games, which open later today. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead as ever, but before all that, Suzanne Chislett has the latest news.
The United Nations Human Rights Council has agreed to begin an international inquiry into violations that may have been committed during Israel's latest military offensive in Gaza. Only the United States voted against the move after an emergency session in Geneva. 17 countries abstained. The UN Human Rights Commissioner Navi Pillay said there's evidence that civilian homes had been targeted. Israel has denied the claim. As peace efforts in the region continue, more and more airlines are now suspending flight routes in and out of Tel Aviv after a Hamas rocket landed just 1 mile away. That's angered the Israeli president, Shimon Peres.
The real answer to the danger of flying is not to stop the flights, but to stop the rockets which are endangering the flight. If any softness or understanding will be shown to the ones who fire the rockets, it's endangering, in my judgment, the air traffic in the entire world.
Attempts to broker a ceasefire are continuing apace, with both the US Secretary of State John Kerry and the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in the region today. They've met officials from both sides and held direct talks to update each other.
I really appreciate Secretary Kerry's very intensive, very dynamic engagement with the world leaders. As I have been doing together, we are now joining our forces and strength to make a ceasefire as soon as possible.
40 bodies of the victims of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 have been returned to the Netherlands. Two military aircraft transported the remains from the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv to Eindhoven. More flights are expected in the coming days. As some relatives watched on at the military base, others were at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, where the flight took off. Dennis Plensiger is the uncle of one of those killed.
He wanted to go on a holiday to Bali. They had a very rough time in the past with the passing of her mother, so they wanted to go on a holiday and it's a shame. It's a shame.
Dutch investigators say initial analysis of the Boeing 777's flight data recorder will begin tomorrow. They've also confirmed the cockpit voice recorder was intact when it was handed over. It's now thought 47 people were killed when a TransAsia Airways plane crashed in Taiwan. The pilot of the domestic flight had requested permission for an emergency landing. Fire officials say there had been thunderstorms in the area at the time. 11 people survived. The Islamist militant group ISIS says one of its fighters carried out a suicide bomb attack in Baghdad last night, which killed 33 people. It was one of the deadliest recent attacks in the Iraqi capital. Today, Iraq's parliament has again delayed a vote to elect a new president. The speaker told politicians the Kurdish representatives wanted more time to select a candidate. Washington has made it clear that setting up a more inclusive government is a requirement for its military support against the insurgents. And the final stages underway of the historic maritime operation removing the stricken Costa Concordia ferry from near the coast of Italy. Today sees the culmination of a 2.5-year project with the vessel moved from Giglio to a scrapyard. 14 ships will be involved in the convoy and a 3-mile exclusion zone is in place around the Concordia as she makes her 4-day journey. 32 people died when the ferry sank in January 2012. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle
24。Oplondo, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 18.06 in London, 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, we have Daniela Pellad from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow with the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both. We will start today once again with Gaza. At least 645 Palestinians, mostly civilians, have now been killed, as well as more than 30 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians. As always, with conflict between Israel and Palestine, and this is the third Israeli assault on Gaza since 2008. The fighting has not been confined to a Middle Eastern battlefield. There have been demonstrations of outrage in streets and social media around the world, some measured and reasonable, some rather less so. In Paris, in particular, synagogues and Jewish-owned businesses were targeted with bricks and Molotov cocktails. Daniela, I'll ask you first. The media has a traditional trope with stories like this of saying that Middle Eastern violence fuels anti-Semitism. Wouldn't exposes be a better word?
Well, it's a very tricky thing. Anti-Semitism is a very difficult beast. And in usual times, I would see it in context with other forms of racism and xenophobia, fears of anti-immigration movements and so on and so forth. But it is true that these things, when there's violence in the Middle East, it does lead to a spike in anti-Semitic attacks. I mean, that's you can track that along the years. The situation in England has been different so far. There was a very large solidarity with Gaza march on Saturday, and I wasn't there myself. I spoke to a lot of people who were there. And with the exception, as you always have in places where they have quite wide coalitions, the odd unpleasant placard, they said the mood was one of really trying to keep things calm and of quite a wide section of quite a wide demographic, not the usual suspects, not just angry, shouting people. I think in England there have been efforts made to try and ratchet down that kind of rabble-rousing. I mean, what happened in Paris, it was just awful, absolutely awful.
Well, I mean, there is a difference between, or at least it strikes me that there's a clear difference between being displeased with the actions of Israel and therefore attending a demonstration outside an Israeli embassy. That's fine. But to then sort of to start throwing bricks at synagogues and at Jewish-owned businesses, that's not just criticism of Israel, is it, Shashank?
Of course, it's completely deplorable and it's on par with other kinds of racist violence and hate speech we've seen again and again over the years in European countries. I think what's interesting is that people don't always help with the way they couch this issue. I noticed a tweet yesterday by a columnist at the Jewish Chronicle, which commented on Ed Miliband's criticism of the Israeli invasion of Gaza. The invasion, mind you, not the airstrikes per se. And she said Ed Miliband has just destroyed his credibility with British Jews. And I thought that was an interesting comment. It may or may not be empirically true that British Jews support Israeli actions or not, but this identification of the community with Israeli actions coming from someone who is a representative at a Jewish publication, a very prominent one, is troubling. It contributes to that sense of association, that false association, a long trope in anti-Semitism to do with dual loyalties, that I think is concerning.
I don't think, though, it's a case of dual loyalties. I think the fact is the majority of British Jews feel empathy with Israel, feel an atavistic connection. Many of them have got family. Many of them really do see that it's the realization of the Jewish homeland, and not unreasonable, they support the existence of Israel as a Jewish state. That's not to say, of course, that they approve of all Israel's actions. But I think as well, there's also some elements of the pro-Palestinian movement try to create a bit of a false division. You know, the ultra-Orthodox Jews who are always trotted out at Palestine Solidarity events, the Netarei Carter, who really aren't representative of the Jewish view on Israel. So I think there is this connection, not an uncritical one, but then again, as we've seen within Israeli society, at times when a country feels under attack, they close ranks, and the sense of solidarity is far, far increased.
Shashank, why do you think there appears to be a particular problem with this in France? There's been incidences of this sort reported all over Europe, up to and including somebody throwing a brick at a synagogue in Belfast, as if Belfast is in a position to lecture other people about sectarian violence. But why does France appear to have a particular problem with it?
It's very hard to say, but I think one contributing factor may, of course, be the political prominence of far-right parties in France over the past 10 years or so. You disagree?
No, I mean, it's a very complex issue, but I think in France there's a very, very large Muslim, very, very large North African population and a very large Jewish population. And they live side by side. They tend to be found in the same areas.
Sure.
And it's a very complex history of French Jews, but a lot of the Jewish community came from North Africa, lower socioeconomic status, and suffer from similar economic problems like the North African population in France. Again, you know, a long history of disenfranchisement and exclusion. So I think the tensions there, people are rubbed together much more closely. Obviously, I'm not in any way justifying it, but I think
it's proximity, which in turn increases these frictions.
I think that plays a large extent. And again, you know, it's a whole issue of a population who feel very angry, a lot of young men, unemployed, all those ill issues in the banlieue, and so on. And so when something like this comes along, an excuse to kick off, shout, attack some convenient symbols, that's what you have.
To what extent, and this has been, this does tend to happen to a greater or lesser extent every time it does kick off in the Middle East. To what extent or not, ask you first, Daniele, do you think this is being fueled or enabled by social media?
It's just horrific. I mean, I have been sitting on my hands and alternately trying to avoid chewing my fingers off. To not avoid and not engage in these social media battles, because really, who are we kidding ourselves that somehow this is going to make some sort of magical difference to what is going on?
And it's really hard
to
imagine anybody's ever thought, wow, that 140 character blurt has completely changed my perspective on the entire Middle East.
Right, but it's compulsive. But actually, both sides, all sides, it's hard to say both sides, this is a conflict with many, many sides, but all sides in this think social media is vital. The Israeli government dedicates enormous resources to it. They call it hasbara, which means explaining. It's a sort of public diplomacy. The idea is if Israelis put their point across, people will somehow understand their point of view and everything will be okay.
Turn shades into propaganda, those things as well.
Yeah, public. There's certainly a very legitimate point. People want to put their point across. But yeah, I think there's a very unpleasant edge. And I think that's really come to the fore in this. This idea of a concept of Pallywood, the idea that the Palestinians are staging many, many of these deaths. What is happening in Gaza is all some sort of
construct. We heard Netanyahu's comment the other day about telogenically dead Palestinians.
Exactly.
Not the happiest choice of phrase.
It's not. It's horribly cynical. But it's true. This is also a battle that's being fought for in the world of public opinion. And all sides and every side and people around the world are throwing themselves into this with enormous enthusiasm. And I kind of despair, because really, what difference is it going to make?
I
noted with interest, by the way, the Israeli government's own mock-ups of various world sites coming under attack from rockets, notably the Houses of Parliament in this country, and with the caption, "What would you do?" And of course, some people did point out, well,
the question
actually,
has been asked
Westminster
and answered,
was attacked, and the people who attacked us are now in Northern Irish Assembly.
But what have you made, though, Shashank, of the use of social media by official sources? Like, well, Hamas and the IDF have been enthusiastic users of official media, and it's been interesting to me how many people are willing to buy directly into their narratives when anybody's ever covered any conflict knows that the absolute first rule is that both sides are lying.
I have to tell you, I think they're swamped. The IDF is desperately trying to get its point of view across. I've seen infographic after infographic explaining how bombs are hidden in mosques or schools, and a portion of that actually is undoubtedly correct. It's true. But I would say it's utterly swamped by the same platform being used by the dozens of superb journalists risking their lives on the ground who are tweeting actual concrete first-hand observations. There could be no better illustration of this than Peter Beaumont for The Guardian and his heart-rending account of four Palestinian children killed on a beach last week. I'm sorry, no amount of IDF tweets will wipe out a Guardian journalist from one of the best foreign journalists out there reporting from the scene that there were no Hamas personnel in the area, that there were no apparently legitimate targets who the boys were shielding, that this wasn't a case of human shields. And yet that one tweet like that, it wipes out weeks of work by the IDF.
Well, one would hope so. We'll move along now to where this all ends. So we've got a few minutes here to try bringing about peace in the Middle East. It's probably not much consolation to either Palestinians enduring a third week of bombardment or to Israelis living under rocket barrages or even to Jewish shopkeepers in Paris. But this will end, and we need to talk about what then. President Mahmoud Abbas met US Secretary of State John Kerry today in Ramallah. Daniela, is Mahmoud Abbas at this point worth talking to?
Well, I'm not quite sure who else we should be talking to as the international community.
That was my follow-up question.
Yes, you know, look, Israel...
Well, someone has to talk to Hamas.
Well, fine. But I mean, as a figurehead, as a person to talk to, as an address, I mean, that's the only address. And Israel missed an enormous chance over the last 7 years of relative quiet in the West Bank and very, very close security cooperation with Palestinian forces there. Failed to strengthen him, failed to build a relationship, failed to move a peace process forward. Because the last 7 years, no matter what's been going on in Gaza, the last 7 years, the West Bank has been very, very stable. The unity government seems to have been torpedoed, along with all kinds of other consequences of this latest incursion. But what the only way forward, really, is for there to be some sort of... linkage between the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, Israel wants to see the West Bank and Gaza as two separate states, Hamasstan, as the Hasbaraists would like to have it. But Palestinians emphatically don't see that. One of the ideas floated is that forces loyal to Mahmoud Abbas will be stationed at the Rafah crossing and stationed at the borders in Gaza. So that's one way of trying to find a way forward out of this. And I think anybody working on any long-time ceasefire plans are also including in that fewer restrictions on fishing and easing movement across the border. So I think that's going to have to be part of any ceasefire.
Shashank, do Hamas emerge from this weaker or stronger than they went into it, do you think?
It's very, very hard to say. I think they emerged from it militarily weakened, but potentially politically strengthened. They were, of course, in a weak financial position before this conflict. After the last conflict, they had big pledges of money from states like Qatar and others, not all of which have come through. Their rocket stockpiles will be depleted. Their tunnels within Gaza will have been crushed in many cases, and their ability to hit Israel through those tunnels will be diminished. It's also possible that Egypt will crack down on them even harder if it feels that smuggling might recommence. So I think they'll come out of this militarily weakened, depleted in that sense, but there will be political support within Gaza for the resistance, and some of that will fall upon Hamas. So some of the plans I've seen, including one mooted today to demilitarize Gaza, and not just to put Abbas's forces on the edge, but to actually demilitarize the whole place and disarm Hamas via international forces in the UN resolution. Well, it's pie in the sky. Hamas is not going away. And I have to say, for all of the rantings of mad people like Lieberman, Avigdor Lieberman, Israel's foreign minister and others, senior Israeli leadership and the IDF recognize getting rid of Hamas, obliterating it, is not what they want, because what's waiting in the wings is not very pretty. And therefore, at the end of the day, actually, I would say we do have an address for Hamas. It's sitting in Doha. That's where Khaled Meshaal's office is. We know where he lives. Everyone knows how you can talk to him. Mahmoud Abbas met him today and chatted to him for a while. In the long term, they're not vanishing. They're not going away. The PA can't just absorb and vanish up Hamas. But I agree entirely, a unity deal will have to be a prerequisite to a long-term solution.
Is there room here for Mahmoud Abbas to actually appear, well, presidential, for want of a better adjective? Is this a moment for him to actually attempt to assert leadership over Palestine as a whole?
Well, he's not really been very good at asserting leadership over Palestine. It's not really his...
I was going to say terribly much, really.
It's not really his style. Now, I mean, the current conflict and what's going on the ground now is really chaotic. But I'm looking forward... a couple of months ahead to the next General Assembly in the UN. And I think that is the next time where Mahmoud Abbas is going to move forward. This strategy of having Palestine recognised in international forums, it's been progressing year by year. And this time around, this round, the peace talks broke down. Kerry clearly blamed Israel for that. We've had this latest round of violence. We don't know. We know it's going to end in some sort of ceasefire, but we don't know to what extent it's going to be pushed. So I think that is the next move at which he's going to assert his presidential status. Yeah. I mean, he's not terribly popular. He's not been strengthened in any way by Israel. He's seen as weak. He's seen as many people see him, as a collaborator in the West Bank. But this is a forum which I think he's got a chance to make something historic. I mean, all this talk of the ICC.
Yeah.
You know, we're not there yet. But just the talk of Israel,
it scares Israel
dreadfully.
And that's the two things you asked. Legitimacy you've mentioned, and the second is cash. Hamas doesn't have cash, he has cash. He has lots of cash rolling in from the international community. Hamas wants some of it to pay their employees, and that's why Abbas is still relevant, despite the mockery.
Okay, well, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, plus Daniela Pellet and Shashank Joshi. When we return, we will turn our attention once again to the investigation into Flight MH17.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Daniela Pellet and Shashank Joshi. Now, the bodies of some of the 298 victims of last week's shooting down of Malaysia Airlines 777 MH17 have begun arriving today in the Netherlands. At the crash site in eastern Ukraine, investigators have begun work at what appears to be a severely compromised crime scene. Shashank, I'll ask you first. Obviously, they have to do this, but is there anything that an investigation into this is going to tell us that we haven't pretty much already figured out?
It adds to the accumulating evidence. We need things like the cockpit door to show us the shrapnel damage so that we can establish what kind of missile may have struck. How far away was it? That could tell us what kind of system was used. Where was it affecting the most? That could tell us the angle it was fired from. So all of these little bits of information are crucial, I think, to rendering the case more credible. If anyone, you know, a US briefing occurred yesterday for the press, and it was chaotic. It was awful. They basically admitted we've had 5 days and we've done far less than a couple of bloggers and tweeters have in establishing what happened. It was an absolute chaos. And Russia Today went obviously nuts with this, saying no evidence of Russia. And actually, you know, this is classic intelligence. We saw this last year with chemical weapons. Every idiot thinks that no evidence of direct Russian link is the same thing as evidence of no Russian link, which are, of course, logically entirely distinct things, but conflated gleefully by the Kremlin. And so that's why it's really important we collect forensically every bit of evidence, however despoiled and desecrated it has by Putin's proxies on the ground.
Russia today has, of course, performed invaluable services as comic relief in an otherwise unremittingly grim story. But, Daniela, we were talking there earlier about competing propaganda in the Middle East. Has Russia now dug itself so far into its narrative that it couldn't actually admit the truth even if it wanted to?
Well, I think it's been quite unapologetic. I mean, the stories that we've heard, I mean, the first thing I heard was that Putin was apparently on the plane. Ukraine thought Putin was on the plane. That's why.
No, they thought it was actually his jet.
Yes, that's why they. Yeah. That's why they.
Because that would be a really sensible thing for Ukraine to do.
Exactly. Yeah. The other thing, or I think they stole this off an episode of Lost, that the plane was already full of dead bodies, or it was the previous. Oh,
yes. It was the previous one.
It was the previous one. I mean, there is no end to this.
The other day they said it was a Sukhoi 25, a Ukrainian one that was seen in the area. But of course, this then transpired the Sukhoi 25's operational ceiling. It's about 10,000 feet lower than the airliner.
But I don't think anybody's worrying about letting a small thing like facts get in the way of a good story. I mean, the narrative is also slightly embarrassingly unsupported by the fact that today the separatists apparently shot down a couple of Ukrainian
two more
fighter jets.
Which it's not really the way to go about demonstrating to the world that you're not shooting down planes.
Having shot down 12 before this, this is no one has registered this. They shot down 12.
This is joined up thinking by the separatists.
Their public relations does need a measure of work. It's probably moving a bit beyond the investigation, but the question is going to turn up of what kind of justice or restitution is available for the families.
Well, we've already got the first stirrings of the very strong moves we're going to take, and I hope you can detect my sarcasm. Apparently, London Mayor Boris Johnson is having second thoughts about playing a charity tennis match because the Russian who won the auction, he says, might be a Putin crony.
This is like boycotting the 1980 Moscow Games.
Right? Well, I mean, these are strong words. These are strong actions coming from the West.
If that doesn't tell them, nothing will. But seriously, though, there are some compensations where guilty countries have acknowledged guilt or compensated people in similar circumstances without really admitting guilt. We saw America pay compensation to the families of the victims of the Airbus shot down by the USS Vincennes. We saw Libya pay into a fund for the families of victims of various outrages which may or may not have been sponsored by Tripoli. Is Russia ever likely to be pressured into that kind of gesture?
Of course not. I mean, even after shooting down this plane, their weapons shooting down this plane, Russia, since the shooting down, has been providing heavy weaponry to the rebels. That was one of the key points at this briefing yesterday. They are unapologetic, is putting it mildly. They are utterly shameless. So the prospect of an apology is completely pie in the sky. I think the best we can hope for is that serious pressure by the EU, you know, God forbid they get their act together, might persuade him to pull support from the rebels because he realizes the risks this has. But an apology, I think this is simply not going to happen. And the US has made it worse by admitting publicly they haven't got the evidence, where they should have just stayed shut and found some.
Why is the EU running so shy of that, though? The so-called level 3 sanctions, the ones which might actually hurt Russia, nobody seems terrifically keen on.
Well, they might actually hurt the EU as well. I mean, they might have something to do with it.
That's all sanctions do, you know.
Is there a chance as well, though, or is there possibly a concern that exerting more pressure on Russia just makes Russia more defensive and paranoid?
I mean, yes, but that case will be strengthened considerably if it looked like Putin was wavering on the edge of being reasonable and you could pull him on with a bit of reasonableness and unilateral concessions. That's, of course, not the case. And the reason the EU isn't doing this is because they're all pointing at each other, squabbling. You know, Cameron saying the French are selling warships to Russia, and the French are saying, well, look at your oligarch backyard first. And then Germany sitting quiet, knowing that 40% of its energy comes from Russia. And this is a depressing indictment of the EU's inability to forge a common position on a
key matter of foreign and security policy, instrumental to its future, they should simply agree sanctions, the burden of sanctions should be borne by all major countries, but of course Germany will have to bear the most, it's most in bed with Russia, and that this is indispensable if Putin is to feel the heat. Otherwise, we're going to see more Ukrainian jets shot down, more arms go to the rebels, and Putin continue to repeat these tricks in other parts of Europe. And that people can't see that, and that the European leaders can't see that, is horribly depressing.
Just on a final thought, and I'll ask you briefly whether you think this is likely to go anywhere. Dutch prosecutors are already looking into the possibility that the shooting down of this jet constitutes a war crime. Does that sound feasible, given that this was a non-state militia acting in, out of disputed territory, possibly accidentally?
I think there's a case to be made for it being a war crime, but it's kind of irrelevant because the hoops that you have to jump through to have a case heard at the ICC or to have any kind of justice for a war crime is so immense, and really it's biggest, you know, perhaps another country, as we were talking about Israel being very frightened of being referred or any connection with the ICC, it would be an attack on its legitimacy and its public image and its sort of soft power. That's not really a problem with Russia. I don't think it's going to frighten anybody.
Shashank,
what soft power?
is that largely a symbolic gesture from the Dutch, do you think?
I think it could have legal ramifications. I don't know what it might mean for example, the Dutch ability to seize Russian assets in the Netherlands. So I can't speak as to the sort of many legal effects that it might have. But initially, when this tragedy did occur, it's worth bearing in mind, first of all, it's probably an accident. They didn't intend to shoot down an airliner, even if they were just extraordinarily reckless. So I don't know if you can commit war crimes by accident. I think you probably can, but it would be an interesting legal case. But the scale of this is the biggest mass atrocity on European soil, really since the Madrid train bombings, maybe since Srebrenica or something, in terms of raw numbers killed in a single incident. And so some legal repercussions, just to set a precedent, I think is important, whatever that leads to.
Okay, Shashank Joshi and Daniela Pellad, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Monocle 24.
Лондонист, Нью Йоркист, Токиост. Се е Monocle 24.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monocle 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. Matt Wolfe tells us what's seeing and what's worth avoiding in London theatres. And Tom McNabb discusses the reissue of his classic novel, Flanagan's Run. But before we get started on all that, Suzanne Chislett has the headlines.
Thank you, Andrew. The United Nations Human Rights Council has agreed to begin an international inquiry into violations that may have been committed during Israel's latest offensive in Gaza. Its top official, Navi Pillay, says there is evidence that civilian homes have been targeted. Israel has denied the claim. Peace efforts are continuing apace in the Middle East, with both the US Secretary of State John Kerry and the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in the region. Both men have met officials from both sides. 40 bodies of the victims of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 have been returned to the Netherlands. A day of national mourning has been declared there. Flags are flying at half-mast. It's now thought 47 people were killed when a Transasia Airways plane crashed in Taiwan. The pilot of the domestic flight had requested permission for an emergency landing in what fire officials said was stormy weather. And Iraq's parliament has again delayed a vote to elect a new president. The speaker told politicians the Kurdish representatives wanted more time to select a candidate. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Suzanne. 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 14:33 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Bamako in Mali, where we can speak to our correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith. Alex, welcome to the show. Mali is apparently now on the list of countries that aircraft won't fly over.
Yes, Mali's been included in the latest list from the Federal Aviation Authority published in the wake of the MH17 downing in eastern Ukraine. Seems to have provided an opportunity to put Mali and seven other African countries on a list where US-registered planes are neither to land nor fly over. And those countries include, I mean, not just Mali, but South Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, others on the continent, Egyptian Sinai, and Kenya and Ethiopia, Somalia, of course, as well. Essentially, seven countries out of the 14 listed on the world list, which where U.S. Registered planes and pilots with Federal Aviation Authority certificates may not land.
Is this really that new? I ask because I flew to Bamako in March on Air France when I noticed from the Sky Tracker screen in front of me it seemed to be taking a fairly conspicuous round-the-way route.
That was probably to avoid Algeria, was it? I don't know what the French rules are about flying to this part of the world. Of course, northern Mali has been the scene of conflict and continues to be. Quite interestingly, the FAA guidelines actually specify that Mali is considered unstable and warn aircraft against flying over it because small arms fire is a danger, rocket-propelled grenades are a danger, rocket and mortar attacks fired from the shoulder are a danger, which is an interesting sort of turn of events because in the past it was always considered unlikely that a plane flying at anything above 15,000 feet would be hit.
On the subject of aeroplanes, then, the saga of Mali's presidential jet, I understand, has taken a somewhat peculiar turn.
Yeah, this is the Boeing 737 that was bought by the government earlier this year for President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, even though Mali already owns a plane, so that makes two planes for one very poor country. The shady circumstances around the purchase of the 737 led the International Monetary Fund to suspend budgetary support to the Malian Treasury, and the European Union and World Bank have since followed suit. What's bizarre at the moment is that the second plane appears to have gone missing. I've noticed myself in the last couple of weeks when I've been at the airport that I couldn't see the aircraft. So you then try to work out, now where is the president at the moment? No, he's probably here, so where is the aircraft? Big mystery. So lots of speculation going on, ranging from it's in for a service in some unknown capital, or perhaps more likely, it's actually needing to have its paperwork revised because President Keita is due to fly to the Africa-US summit at the beginning of August, and there are fears here that unless the paperwork is in order, that plane will be impounded in the United States.
Well, more positively, there's been talks going on in Algiers trying to come up with some way to get peace negotiations in northern Mali to occur, some sort of settlement, I guess, between the Tuareg and the rest of the country in particular. How is that progressing?
Well, it's quite hard to say from this end. The Algerians have given a few interviews, a few press briefings, as talks have ended at the end of each day in the past week. They're going to end finally tomorrow, due to resume in mid-August. And the Algerian foreign minister says that he's hoping for a peace deal at the end of October, which would be signed in Mali. The talks are quite complex because they involve six armed groups, none of them jihadist armed groups, but all of them to some degree or other secessionist armed groups, either speaking for the Tuareg minority or for the Arab minority in the north. So quite a lot of displeasure in southern Mali that the black majority population of the north is not represented except by the government, and black Malians of the north don't always feel that the government is its best representative. So it's actually, yes, you said good news. I think we're going to have to wait and see whether it's good news. There have been peace deals in the past brokered by Algeria, and they've only led to a resumption of fighting.
Alex Duval-Smith in what sounds like a very rainy Bamako, thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we'll be meeting the author, athlete and coach and much more besides Tom McNabb. Do stay tuned.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design, and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino, and our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
A nation defining its identity or architectural vandalism, Monocle Films heads to the capital of the Republic of Macedonia to investigate a controversial building project.
Museums, theatres and government ministries have sprouted up along the riverbank, and with their neoclassical and Baroque stylings, the Skopje 2014 building boom harks back to the past. It's nothing less than eyebrow-raising, and for some, it's positively stomach-churning.
Skopje 2014, an architectural facelift, now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, as the many of you who've been anxiously peeling windows off their Commonwealth Games advent calendars these last few weeks will be aware, the opening ceremony of the 2014 Glasgow Games is just hours away. It is, as I have just demonstrated, quite easy to be somewhat glib about the former British Empire Games, especially when they're held, as these will be, in the shadow of a triumphant London Olympics. But it's still a gathering of some of the best athletes on earth who will still be accomplishing the extraordinary over the coming weeks. But few of the feats to which we might be shortly be treated will compare with the yarn unfurled in Flanagan's Run, Tom McNabb's 1982 novel about a foot race across the US, which has just been reissued to coincide with the Glasgow Games. Tom joins us now. Tom, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
You've been a Scottish triple jump champion yourself and a coach of a lengthy and bizarre array of sports. Are you looking forward to the Commonwealth Games? Do you still get excited about them?
Oh, immensely, yes. It's going to be the greatest games ever, in my view. Mainly because it's in Scotland.
not that you're biased or anything.
I'm not biased. No, I think we're ideally suited to the Commonwealth Games because I've been there many times and it's a friendly games, and I think people at Glasgow are ideally suited to deliver it.
Do you still get as excited about an athletics meet as you ever did? Has it changed very much from when you've competed and coached?
Or changed radically. I mean, we ran on football fields and I'd never seen a track until I was about 21. We jumped into big piles of sand in a high jump. So, I mean, the Fosbury flop would have meant a relatively short season for you.
a sort of one jump and then 6 months in traction.
Oh, 6 months would be pretty generous.
You at various points, having dipped in and out of a career in coaching, you worked as a technical advisor on Chariots of Fire, and that inspired you, if I've got this right, to write Flanagan's Run.
Oh, not quite. I'd started on Flanagan's Run before Chariots. In fact, they ran parallel to each other, really.
Okay.
And I'd started on Flanagan's Run in 1978, and I was involved with Colin Welland on the script around about the same time, so they ran alongside each other. Yes,
it is this extraordinary saga of a foot race across the United States, based on one which something similar which actually happened.
Two races, one in 28 and the other one in 1929. In 28 from Los Angeles to New York and 29 from New York to Los Angeles.
So why go with the fictionalised version at the time rather than just a straightforward non-fiction chronicle of the actual races?
Well, I mean, fiction sort of gives you freedom to magnify the whole situation and amplify it. For instance, there are only about 200 runners in the original one, and I gave me 2,000. I can leave 2,000, no problems. No one checks it out. It gives you freedom to create new characters and do all sorts of things that you couldn't possibly do if you stuck to the facts.
Because you did assemble for Flanagan's Run this extraordinary cast of characters who are competing in this great enterprise of running all the way across the United States. Were they all complete inventions, or were they based on people you'd met, or amalgamated components of people you'd met?
Well, some of them were bits of me. Dislocated bits of me. Where Flanagan, the sort of P.T. Barnum character who drives the whole process, that drives the race and who runs the race, and that was a bit of my sort of more flamboyant character. And then Doc Cole, who's the older runner, the coach type, advising all the others, busybody, that's another bit of me. And the Scottish runner McPhail is a younger version of me, so I appear in various manifestations throughout the plot.
Were you surprised by the success of it? Because it has become something of a resounding classic. I mean, to write a book that anybody pays any attention to at all is remarkable, but to write a book that people think is worth re-releasing decades later is extraordinary.
Well, I was very fortunate. It went to the top of the bestseller list in its first week, which was quite remarkable. I mean, there were characters like Wilbur Smith below me, and I didn't even know who he was at the time. So I don't read much fiction. I read lots of nonfiction. So I was, and it went into, it's gone into about, it's come out in Czechoslovakian and Dutch this year, and it was into Spanish last year and Israeli. So it's still going the rounds, and we're now looking through Bill Kirbishley, who was the manager of The who was the guy who brought Harvey Weinstein to me for the movie. Bill's now reviving the idea of making it into a two-hour-plus movie.
This was a question I was coming up to. It seems bizarre that it hasn't been a movie, really. It seems that you may have, of course, put too many runners in it. There is that old saw about screenwriting, that you can put anything in a novel. You can say 500 camels came over the hill in a novel, but in a screenplay there's someone going, where do I find 500 camels? What do they eat? Do I need a permit?
Well, you can digitize now. So you can digitize your camels. So really, now it's much easier to make now for Harvey Weinstein than it was when he first bought it in 1990. He's had it for 20 years. And I wrote the original screenplay as well. He was very generous to me, Harvey. So it's easier to make it now with digitization than it ever was when it was first taken up by Harvey.
So Flanagan's Run with 500 digital camels.
What's the crowds and things like that? The New York of 1931. You can make it out with digitization. If you look at The Great Gatsby, most of it was digitized.
Yeah, true enough. You have also written, I guess, semi-nonfiction. I did want to ask about your play 1936, which, as the title suggests, was about the 1936 Berlin Olympics and a kind of exploration of the politicization of sport. Is that inevitable? Because every time at every World Cup, like we've just seen, every Olympics, there's always people suggesting that politicians X or Y or country Z or Q is trying to leverage it for political advantage. That's just inevitable. Isn't it?
It was true from 1896 when de Coubertin first created the Games. It was, they had to go through the Greek political process in order to get the Games held in Athens. And then they had to look to a man called Averrof, who lived in Istanbul, who's a Greek tradesman, or a Greek businessman, and he put a lot of the money in to build the Averrof Stadium, in which the Games were held. So the whole setup, commercial and political, was there right from the word go. It wasn't something that entered at a later point.
Now, on that subject, then, about the Glasgow Games, with obviously a referendum on independence 2 months from now, or a little bit less maybe, how hard or otherwise do you think Scotland will work to resist the temptation to turn this into kind of an advertisement for a yes vote?
Well, Alex Salmond must be sort of biting his lip on this one. He made a boy, he's got a fair lip to bite in the lip-biting profession. But, I mean, he made a faux pas last year with a saltar behind Murray. That was a bad mistake. And I think the less he makes of it, the better.
I agree with you. I have one final question to ask you, which I have mixed feelings about asking you, speaking as an Australian, and you may have mixed feelings about answering, but you have coached everything from rugby to bobsleigh. Given the recent abject showings of England's football and cricket teams, would you have any general advice you would wish to impart to them?
Actually, in international terms, British sport has the most successful sports systems in the world at the moment. All that we're seeing is a temporary blip. I mean, not in terms of football, because we haven't been any good at that since 1966. But basically, we have the best sports system on earth in terms of developing young athletes, weightlifters, gymnasts, etc., through UK sport. So this is just happens to be a temporary aberration, I think, the cricket and the football.
Well, speaking as an Australian, I can't tell whether or not I hope that's true. But Tom McNab, author of Flanagan's Run, reissued right now. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's time now to review the best, occasionally the worst, in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books, etc. Today, it's the turn of theatre, and we are once again joined by the eminent theatre critic, Matt Wolfe. Matt, welcome back to the programme.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
I thought we'd upgrade you to eminent on this occasion.
I feel very upgraded.
You're four more appearances away from omniscient. we should start. We'll start first with a new production of Medea, which is, Hardy Perennial hardly does it justice. First produced, it says here, in 431 BC. Yeah. Nearly 2,500 years later, what is there that one can do with Euripides?
Well, make jokes about it. But aside from that, you can play the title character very grandly, very gutturally, as a sort of sorceress, witch, she-devil, whatever. What Helen McCrory, who's the wonderful actress playing Medea here, does is make her a sort of every woman. She comes on in her husband's sort of combat trousers, looking like somebody that you might pass on the street. She's not elegant the way Dana Rigg once was. She's somebody that you might see around you, capable, an ordinary woman who, in the course of the play, does extraordinary things. I'm not sure if I should reveal what those are in case there is the odd listener that doesn't actually know. But it's a play steeped in truly unspeakable violence, which is the sort of violence that resonates across all time.
Unspeakable violence does, of course, have a timeless appeal. This is, we should mention, the National's new production of Medea here in London. Have they done it? Because there's often the temptation or the obligation with such ancient productions as this to try and hook it to some kind of contemporary event or zeitgeist. Do they do that?
Right. No, you're right. I mean, kind of the Iraq War, Henry V, or whatever.
Something like that.
No,
yes.
This is just a modern Medea. But even the modernity of it, yes, there's a mobile phone. Yes, at the very beginning of the play, you see her two children watching television. But it isn't, oh, let's see how much gadgetry we can attach to a 2,500-year-old play. It just when you think you've located the period, something about Tom Scott's wonderful two-tier design throws you off. I should say also that it's a real piece of total theater. It's got an astonishing original score, which acts as an ambient soundscape. It's got a really fantastic use of choreography for the chorus of the piece, who are the women of Corinth, who act as a sort of externalization of Medea's tortured conscience. And when the horrible ending arrives, it's inevitable and tragic and really quite disturbing.
So even for people who think they've got the idea 2,500 years later, it's still worth seeing?
Yeah, what's interesting too is this production is kind of grimly funny. The thing you realize about Medea is she's a barbarian, but she's an intelligent barbarian. And a lot of what she says is very witty. So there is even the odd laugh.
Okay, well, we should move along to another play that listeners may have heard of or indeed seen or actually probably appeared in once or twice. It's not quite as old as Medea, but it is getting there. This is Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. It's now at the Harold Pinter Theatre here in London. Why produce or indeed go and see this again now?
Well, this production, I would not encourage, sadly, our listeners to go and see. This production, although it's an immortal comedy from Oscar Wilde dating, as you say, back to 1895, there are almost no laughs in this production. There are more laughs in Medea.
Hang on. Somebody's managed to do Oscar Wilde without the laughs.
Yeah, I don't think that was the intention. That's the result. What's happening here is that the two principal actors, Martin Jarvis and Nigel Havers, played the roles that they're playing in this production 32 years ago at the National Theatre for Peter Hall. They had a great time when they were young and larky playing these parts, and they wanted to do it again. The fact that one of them is 72 and the other is 60-something has, of course, to be explained within the context of the production. So they've added stuff, not by Oscar Wilde,
oh dear,
to give the thing a kind of framing device. And then they kind of back into the play as if they're embarrassed by doing the play. So then you think, why am I watching actors playing a play that they don't feel confident with?
Because isn't the self-evident point that the importance of being earnest is pretty much entirely about Dim Young Men on the Make?
Yeah, and they give kind of backstories or additional stories to the actors within the play, if you follow me, so that the Nigel Havers is playing an actor who is himself a layabout and a gadfly, just like Algernon Moncrief, the character he's playing in Wilde's play. And Wilde doesn't need this. Wilde's play is wonderful enough and witty enough not to need tinkering with. So one star from me.
and presumably the additional material, is there an audible grinding of gears?
Yeah, particularly at the beginning, because they have to set up why it is. I mean, Sean Phillips, wonderful to see her on stage, 81, I think she is, playing Lady Bracknell. And that sort of works. I mean, Lady Bracknell kind of transcends age. She can be any age, and in fact, any gender. Next year, we're having David Suchet, who is, of course, a man, on the West End playing Lady Bracknell. So that just about works, but the rest of it is so busy tying itself into knots that it's just hugely dispiriting.
Okay, well, we should move along from that to a play which does have about as clear and zeitgeisty a reason for existing as you could possibly imagine. This is the Nicholas Hytner production of Great Britain at the National Theatre from now until August 23rd. This is Richard Bean's reaction to the recent... I don't even know where you start. The recent ructions which have gripped Great Britain's tabloid press and political establishment, resulting in the arrest and imprisonment of several high-profile journalists, including one who used to work for the Prime Minister. One of those things where you would have to think, on the one hand, ripe for satire, on the other hand, can satire keep up with the reality?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, the truth of all of these incidents surrounding the Rebecca Burks trial is so extraordinary, not least for many people who are acquittal, that it sort of defies theatrical analysis. On the other hand, if you're going to do it, you might as well just treat it as this raw slab of theatrical meat, which has been thrown on the griddle in this case being the Littleton Theatre stage, to great success. It's already announced a transfer to the Haymarket on the West End in the autumn. So clearly, commercially, it's clicking. The problem with the play, which I admire plays that respond to the moment in the moment, but you feel at every turn kind of the long lens, or maybe not so long lens, of lawyers looking at every single character, every single detail. Is that going to result in litigation? So you think the Rebecca Brooks character is Rebecca Brooks, but she isn't quite. There are events that are referred to that we know from recent history that aren't quite. So the whole thing operates at sort of a 45-degree angle. That said, it's very entertaining, and it's more entertaining the more you know about these things.
Finally, we should pause to pay tribute to a passing Broadway legend, Elaine Stritch.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, what can one say? For many of us, I grew up in New York and saw her on stage 6 or 7 times. For many of us, she was inseparable from the New York theater. There was something brassy, indomitable, rude, snarky, but also kind of underneath all that, quite sentiment prone, that seemed absolutely linked to the city in which she lived. She wasn't from New York, she was from Michigan. And at the end of her life, she went back to Michigan. And as soon as she went back to Michigan, what was the first thing she said? She missed New York. She missed the kind of energy, the aggression, all the stuff that made her great. She had a very odd voice. It was sort of brassy, raspy, aggressive, but it was distinctive and great. She was a true one-off.
And she did, of course, have a late life renaissance in TV sitcom in 30 Rock, which we do have a clip of.
Exhibit A! Your cell phone bill. You made a call to 911 at 8:16 a.m. Exhibit B, the watch that my son gave me for Christmas, not the one I wanted, by the way. You had just set it before it broke, of course, when your car rammed into me down in Florida, and it stopped at 8:08. Exhibit C, 16 minus 8 is 8. Numbers, unlike children, don't lie.
the late, great Elaine Stritch there in rare form in 30 Rock. 30 Rock aside, though, Matt, what should she really be remembered for? TV obviously has a shelf life that theatre does not, but what will she really be recalled for?
And she did win 3 Emmy Awards, which is no mean feat. And of course, it's wonderful that a broad public knows her for playing Alec Baldwin's mum in 30 Rock. But I think for those of us who love the American theatre, and particularly the American musical theatre, she'll be most remembered for originating a song in Stephen Sondheim's musical company in 1970 called The Ladies Who Lunch, which she once described as a four-act play in one song. And I urge everyone listening to immediately go and look it up on YouTube. Her delivery of it is absolutely Broadway at its best. And she, her like will not be seen again.
That was the theatre critic Matt Wolfe, and that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Daniela Pellet and Shashank Joshi. The show was produced by Marika Peters, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Up after the headline is The Culture Show with Rob Bound. At 2200 hours, I'm back with Chloe Potter for The Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, from Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.